morning is John Canese versus the Village of Melrose Park.
Good morning. May it please the court. Ruth Major on behalf of the appellant John Canese. Mr. Canese was a firefighter with the Village of Melrose Park for 16 years. He had never had any disciplinary issues. He had an unblemished record. He grew up in Melrose Park as well. His complaint in federal court alleging due process and equal protection violations was dismissed on a 12B6 motion to dismiss by the trial court. There are three errors in that led to the decision to dismiss his case, and I'll address them one at a time. The first error in the trial court's decision involved the issue of whether or not Mr. Canese was entitled to due process before being terminated. Because, as I'll address later on in the argument, he raised an argument that he did not receive due process because of the bias of the panel. In Loudermill, in Cleveland, I'm sorry.
Mr. Canese was provided a hearing before the board in this case, in which he filed a motion challenging the ex parte communications. He was represented by counsel. Why isn't that the notice and opportunity to be heard that is required by the due process clause? If he believed the board was wrong in its decision or was biased, was there an opportunity to raise that in an administrative review action? And if there was, why isn't that process sufficient to satisfy the Constitution?
Well, the Supreme Court in Loudermill held that an employee has a right to due process before termination, regardless of how robust, to the extent the administrative proceedings are considered robust, which is another issue, but an employee has a right to the minimum due process protections before termination. In this case, Mr. Canese alleged that the tribunal was biased, and in his complaint, he alleged that the attorney for the board was ex parte providing case law concerning the main issues in this case to the prosecuting attorney. And there were other communications as well, ex parte, between the prosecuting attorney and the board attorney. The board the attorney was counsel to the board. He's part of the board. And
is there any knowledge that the board members themselves engaged in any improper communications?
Well, the counsel for the board under Illinois law is considered part of the board. I mean, he is part of the board.
Board member.
I'm sorry.
The counsel is not a member of the board.
Well, the counsel is, the attorney is providing legal advice to the board, and under Illinois law is considered part of the board. And that was...
I'm not asking you that. I am, again, going to ask you, is counsel a board member?
I don't know. He's not a board member. He's not a board member. So the facts that were alleged in the complaint were that there were these ex parte communications between the counsel for the board and the prosecuting attorney. There was no the ruling on the motion to recuse either the panel or the attorney or the prosecuting attorney was denied without argument. It was summarily denied. And then the board went on to have a hearing with one witness, Mr. Canese, no witness impeaching him. All the favorable testimony he provided was disregarded in the ruling. Testimony he provided was misrepresented in the ruling. and any inferences that could be drawn, even from testimony that wasn't disputed, was drawn against Mr. Kenichi. So in the complaint, we argued that in the complaint we alleged that all this evidence is evidence of a sham proceeding and that he was denied due process. This court in Schacht versus Wisconsin Department of Corrections recognized that on a motion to dismiss, where there's allegations of that nature, the case should proceed, discovery should take place, and then at a later date, when all the evidence has been obtained to fully explore the issues, the court can determine whether there is sufficient evidence to find bias or not find bias. But this complaint alleged from the beginning to the end that there were ex parte discussions and that this board, there was no evidence contrary to Mr. Kenichi's testimony and no evidence that he had any intent not to remain a resident. The court did not follow Illinois, ignored his testimony.
That communication between the counsel for the board and the prosecutor seemed to have consisted solely of three cases regarding procedural requirements for scheduling an agreed hearing and residency issues.
Well, he was sending to the prosecuting attorney the seminal Illinois appellate decision addressing residency ordinance is in the employment context. He sent him the main case on this issue, and it's the equivalent of a judge ex parte giving one of the attorneys some case law to help them, a prosecuting attorney case law to help them prosecute a case. And I don't believe under U.S. Supreme Court decision and this court's decisions that is a fair trial. That's not a fair hearing. And under Loudermill, he's entitled to the minimum protections of due process before termination. It's not okay to say, oh, he didn't get it, you know, but we'll make up for it on the back end. Loudermill is very clear. Termination of employment is a very, very significant event. It deprives somebody of their livelihood, and they have a right to have due process before. Now, one of the other errors in the court's decision was that the court determined that Mr. Kenichi was not entitled to due process before termination under the Supreme Court's random and unauthorized analysis. But that analysis has been limited to very special cases where there is no state procedure to govern the deprivation and where the government has no way to predict that a deprivation will occur. It's been reserved for cases where the Supreme Court has said, and this is a quote, it's impossible for the government to predict that there will be a deprivation. It is not under controlling case law, which in this case is the Zinnerman case. Random and unauthorized is not appropriate where the deprivation occurs through a government proceeding. Now, the lower court, I believe, and some courts have done this, have said that, well, the abuse of discretion is not predictable. The government couldn't predict that the board's counsel would be, you know, that kind of thing, would be doing these kinds of things or ignoring the law. But the Supreme Court in Zinnerman said, that's not the focus. The focus is whether the deprivation could be predicted to occur, not whether the misconduct, the abuse of authority by the government official was unpredictable. Because, you know, that's almost always going to be unpredictable. So Zinnerman is controlling here, and this court has followed the Zinnerman analysis as well in Armstrong versus Daly. In Armstrong versus Daly, this court acknowledged that random and unauthorized is not talking about a case where there's a state procedure, but the official abuses its authority, and that wasn't predicted. So in this case, whenever there's a state procedure under Zinnerman, whenever there's a state procedure, and there is an abuse of due process, it is not random and unauthorized. And Zinnerman is very clear on that point. The court just said, It's random and unauthorized. I think because the conduct was not predictable that he would abuse, that the panel would abuse its authority. The third basis for overturning this is the equal protection claim. The court found that Mr. Kenichi was not entitled to equal protection in the employment context. The seminal Supreme Court decision on that is Inquist. Inquist versus Oregon Department of Agriculture. Mr. Kenichi was not an Atwell employee. Mr. Kenichi was protected from arbitrary terminations by state law. He could only be terminated for cause. Mr. Kenichi was not terminated because of your sort of typical, you know, discretionary, you know, I don't think you, you know, hook up the hose right, or I don't like the way. He was terminated based on an ordinance, based on a law. The Inquist case deals with a case where the employee is an at-will employee who is terminated for purely discretionary reasons, not based on an ordinance. In Inquist, they go to great pains to talk about what they're trying to do there is balance equal protection rights in employment, and the case law is clear that when you go to work for a public employer, you don't leave your constitutional rights at the door. You bring them in and they apply at work. The question in Inquist was, does equal protection, our concerns about equal protection, outweigh the principles of at-will employment? The whole case was about at-will employment. And the court said that they put weight and they put importance on at will. And they said because it's at will, we're not going to apply equal protection here. And they went on and said, you know, in this case, in this context, and there are lots of caveats about this case. But the whole case was about, one, that it was at will and balancing equal protection against at will, and two, it was about that it was a discretionary termination, not based on an ordinance or a law, like in the Olick decision, which is another Supreme Court decision that we address in the briefs. And the Inquist Court talked a lot about Olick. In Olick, a single person brought an equal protection claim against their village because an ordinance was not being applied fairly to them.
So you're saying then that he wasn't terminated because of his lack of residency then?
He was terminated because of his lack of residency, is what they said. But that is not a subjective test. They applied objective criteria there. The criteria they looked at was, where did he sleep? Where did his family live? Where was his property? That's objective criteria. And the Inquist decision goes through similar cases where there's an ordinance which may at first blush appear to be discretionary, but the criteria that's looked at is objective criteria. And the court said because it's objective criteria and it's an ordinance, equal protection does apply. That was Olick and the cases, other cases that are addressed in Inquist. Now, in this case, you know, we're saying that same kind of criteria, there are people that work for the fire department and still work for the fire department, as we understand it, who don't even live in Illinois. Their families live in Wisconsin, or they live in other towns far away, and they're still there because of their relationship, their business dealings with the mayor. They're still there, but Mr. Kenichi was terminated. And this this court has...
Ms. Major, in the complaint, are there allegations the persons who did business with the mayor were allowed to bypass the resident requirement, or any allegation that he was treated differently on that basis?
Your Honor, I'll find them during my break, and if it's okay if I can cite to them in rebuttal. There are many, many allegations.
You're not going to have any time for rebuttal if you keep talking.
I know, that's why I'm trying to stop. So, and just want to say, Abkarian versus McDonald was a case where the Seventh Circuit acknowledged that Inquist is talking about not cases with ordinances and discretionary decisions. And I think I have 1 minute left, so thank you.
May it please the court, Austin Zimmer on behalf of the appellees. Mr. Kenichi is a white male. He's not a member of protected class. Prior to his termination for violating the Village of Melrose Park's residency ordinance, he was given written notice of the charges. He was provided an opportunity to tell his story with his lawyer. He told his story, and he testified for about 3 years he slept every night in Orland Park, not in the Village of Melrose Park. After his termination, he filed an action under the Illinois Administrative Review Act. For those reasons, he's unable to successfully plead any constitutional claims against the village. The district court's decision to grant our motion to dismiss was proper, and this court should uphold this decision. Let's start with the due process. As this court is well aware, under the Loudermill decision, all that's required under the due process clause is a pre-termination notice and post-termination procedures. Clearly here, Mr. Kenichi was given pre-termination requirements. He was given much more than even Loudermill requires. He was given notice of the hearing. He was given written charges. He was allowed to present his evidence with his lawyer.
Was this three-year time period part of this pre-termination? When was the village or whatever it is aware of his living somewhere else?
Sure. So sometime, I believe, around 2014 or 2015, the village started investigating residency violations of its police officers and its firefighters.
Well, in general, they were doing?
They were generally investigating it.
Okay. And then when they ran across his name, at what stage of the termination was? How long before he was actually terminated?
At about approximately 2016, they call him in and they say, "Hey, what's going on? We think you live out of town." Ask him some questions. After that brief interview, then they give him written charges, and then he's presented with the written charges. He's allowed to retain his lawyer, and then he has the hearing in front of the Board of Fire and Police, where he's allowed to present his case, where he's given the opportunity to state his story and explain why he shouldn't be
terminated. That's in 2016?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not that, in hindsight, they find out this was going on for 3 years. Is that what you're saying?
This is the testimony of Mr. Kenichi from the hearing. He admitted that from 2013 to 2016, that he slept every night in the Orland Park home and not the Village of Melrose Park residence.
This was his addition. But he maintained some kind of a residence in the basement of the house that he rented to somebody else, another family?
That was his way to try to comply, what he thought was complying with the residency ordinance. He rented out the house. He had space available, supposedly in the basement, but he never slept there, and he was collecting rent. Besides the pre-termination requirements, Loudermill requires some sort of post-termination procedures. Here, the Illinois Administrative Review Act provided Kenichi with the post-deprivation remedy that is required under the law after he was terminated. In fact, he filed a lawsuit under that act, and following the district court's dismissal of the Section 1983 claims, the Administrative Review Act was remanded to state court. The Administrative Review Act provides a remedy for the sort of due process violation that's alleged here. The fact is, the opportunity to litigate...
In other words, if Mr. Kenichi believed that the board was biased against him, there was an avenue available for him to appeal that board determination in which he could assert the claim of bias. Is that correct?
You are 100% right, Your Honor, and the law is clear on that. A biased decision maker at a pre-termination hearing doesn't violate due process as long as there's an adequate post-deprivation hearing by an unbiased decision maker. And that's the Mikulitz case that this court decided, and the facts in that case are very similar. That dealt with Bedford Park, and there was a hearing before the board of trustees, and in that case, the plaintiff alleged the board was biased against him. And this court said clearly that a biased decision maker at a pre-termination hearing won't violate the due process as long as there's adequate post-deprivation hearing. And in this case, there was an adequate post-deprivation hearing, and that's the Illinois Administrative Review Act, which plaintiff filed an action under, which was remanded to state court, and which plaintiff had a hearing at. And in December of last year, the circuit court judge upheld the decision to terminate Mr. Kenichi. And what's important is that these administrative review actions, you're allowed to bring the whole record in. And one of the things you're allowed to bring in is bias. So this was addressed, and they gave, were given an opportunity to address the issue of bias. But another important point is there was no allegation that the board was actually biased. The allegations of bias had to do with the board's attorney. The board's attorney was not a decision maker. The board's the decision maker. The motion to disqualify that Mr. Kenichi brought, it was to disqualify the board's counsel, not the board. So even if that motion would have been granted, it'd be the board that was still making those decisions. Kenichi also takes issue with the district court's characterization that this was a random and unauthorized decision. Again, I would point the court to its own decision in the Mikulowicz versus Bedward Park case. That was a very similar case where there was an allegation of bias, and that's why due process was violated, because of bias. And in that case, this court stated that biased decision makers are properly characterized as random and unauthorized. The district court's decision in our case to conclude that this was random and authorized was supported by the case law. If you review plaintiff's complaint, you know, the other type of procedural due process claim is those based upon established state procedures. The allegations regarding due process in the complaint are only about four paragraphs long, and there's no allegations that Mr. Kenichi's rights were violated by an established state procedure. And the reason why he didn't allege that is because he can't. There's no way you can allege any deficiencies with the process. He was given all the opportunities that are required under the law to be heard, to tell a side of this story. And then he was given an opportunity under the Illinois Administrative Review Act to appeal those decisions. So this was clearly random and unauthorized decision, and the district court's characterization of that was proper. Also, Mr. Kenichi takes issue with the alleged ex parte discussions and states that's another reason that deprived him of a fair hearing. First, I would submit that even if these communications did deprive him of a fair hearing, because there was adequate post-deprivation remedy under the Illinois Administrative Review Act.
I understand that the conversation only had to do with discussions of points of law.
Sure, and what it was, discussions not between a decision maker, not between a board member, between the attorney. Yeah. And what it was at the first hearing, and under state law, you have to proceed to the hearing in 30 days, and it was case law about that. And there was a conversation about, there's a new residency case that came out, and he forwarded it to the board's attorney, forwarded it to the prosecutor. The prosecutor then forwarded it on to Kenichi's attorney. It had nothing to do with the substantive decision. The decision was made by the board, not the board's attorney. If you review the transcript from the hearing, the board's attorney did not sustain any objections against Mr. Kenichi. This issue was ruled upon at the Illinois Administrative Review hearing in the circuit court in December, and Judge Cohen in that case, he concluded that these weren't ex parte conversations because ex parte communications need to be made between a decision maker and an interested party. Mr. O'Connor, the board's attorney, was not a decision maker.
Who is that? And I'm sorry, when that that you said a judge, was this an administrative judge of some kind?
This is a Cook County Circuit Court judge. So the Illinois Administrative Review claim that Judge Buckle remanded to state court, okay, that's been proceeding while this case has been on appeal. And in December, he ruled on their Illinois Administrative Review Law claim, and he sided with the village and upheld the termination of Mr. Kenichi.
And I guess that was an appealable decision.
They have filed a motion to reconsider, and that's pending before the circuit court now. As to equal protection, Kenichi's allegations do not involve an equal treatment as a result of a membership in a protective class. They can't. He's a white male. The Inquist case makes it clear that a class of one claim, it has no place in the public employment context. As recently as October of last year, this court held in Ford versus City of Chicago that disputes related to a public employee's interactions with superiors never, that's the key word, never may be litigated under the Equal Protection Clause. To allow such claims would impact the ability of a government to function, because every single hiring and firing and transfer decision by a government employer would be subjected to constitutional scrutiny. Mr. Kenichi does not have an equal protection claim. Counsel cited in her argument to Olick. Olick is a case that did not involve an employee of the government. Olick involved a case where it was a citizen of the government, and that citizen was being treated with regards to water rights differently than other citizens, very different than public employees. And that's the key for this court's analysis and why Judge Buckle granted our motion to dismiss the equal protection claim, because Mr. Kenichi is a government employee and he cannot bring a class of one claim. Accordingly, Mr. Kenichi does not have any viable constitutional claims he can bring against any of the defendants. Judge Buckle's decision was proper under the law and would respectfully request that this court uphold the district court's decision.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have 52 seconds. It's your fast you can talk.
Okay. First, in response to your question, Judge Rovner, paragraph 73 through 89 of the complaint in paragraph 107 list the number of employees we knew of pre-discovery who did not live in the state or in Melrose Park. Their families didn't live there. Their kids went to schools like in different states, and they still work there. Mr. Kenichi does not. They had business relationships with the mayor. Mr. Kenichi did not. The state law that was before the board is MAC. It's a decision. It's Maxim. It involves Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And in that case, the Illinois Supreme Court held that you have to have, once the residency is achieved, accomplished as it was here, you have to have physical absence plus intent not to retain your residency. You have to have both. Physical absence isn't enough. And the issue in the hearing before the board was there was no evidence of his intent.
That's it.
May I wrap it up? Or?
Okay, wrap it up.
With regard to the bias, the Supreme Court has said in Logan versus Zimmerman, and as well as in the case, and these are cases addressed in the brief, and in Withrow versus Larkin, that having your matter fairly judged. What's that?
You're not racking it up. You're just going on with your argument.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was my last point. Just that those two decisions say a fair decision maker is an absolute requirement of due process. And Withrow involves the administrative setting. It's always got to be there for due process. This decision should be reversed, and I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Case will be taken under advisement. Thank you to both counsel.
Judge Bauer, may we take a break, please?
We may. Court will take a brief recess.